Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behaviour nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Sarah Owings. Sarah is a Karen Pryor Academy certified training partner. She specializes in the practical application of behavioral principles to help transform the lives of fearful, shut down, and over-the-top dogs. As the owner of Bridges Dog Training, an international speaking and regular contributor to online training forums, she is known for her innovative approaches to tough behavior problems and her compassionate and insightful teaching. Sarah has written for Clean Run magazine on topics such as stimulus control, release cues, and toy-related cues, and serves as faculty at Clicker Expo, an instructor for Karen Pryor Academy, and an advisor to the Glendale Humane Society in Los Angeles. She is also an avid nose work competitor, currently competing at the elite level with her dog Tucker. Sarah recently moved from Los Angeles to San Rafael, California, with her two dogs, two geriatric rabbits, and her husband, Fred. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one Sarah Owings to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Sarah, how are you?
Hi, Ryan. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming and hanging out here at Animal Training Academy.
I'm very excited about it.
Me too. We haven't nerded out to the level I think we're going to nerd out on the topics we're going to talk about today on the show. So very excited. We're going to dive straight into the first question today, Sarah. Could you please take everyone listening back to where you first started to learn about positive reinforcement animal training and share some stories from some of the first animals you ever trained using it?
Okay. Well, I've been a long time animal person from a very, very early age. My mom had like 14 cats growing up, dogs, mice, snakes, I mean, all species. And one of the earliest memories I have actually, or maybe it's just a family story, is my mom was taking a shower. And when she came out, I was sitting in the kitchen with 12 cats around me in a circle. And I had a little pat of butter. I think I must have been about four. And I was going, "Some for you, some for you, some for you." So that was probably my first experience using primary reinforcement to get calm group behavior from a group of cats. From there, I got very involved with horses, which, of course, all that was traditional-based training back in the early days when I was young. But that did give me lots of experience with large animals as well. Then I got through life. Many different tangents happened that did not involve animals, but a lot of other learning happened. And I came around full circle when I adopted a young pit bull puppy. And back then, the only really methods I had in my mind were traditional based. methods. And like many dog trainers before me, I reached a place where applying those traditional methods was very, very clear to me that the problems were getting worse. The aggression and fear was getting larger. And I felt terrible doing these things to her. And the most important question came into my mind. I'll never forget the day. The question, and this has pretty much driven my entire career ever since, the question was, there has to be a better way than this. And I've always come back to that. Even when I became a positive reinforcement trainer, I still ask that question, is there a better way than this? Can we go deeper? Can we do this with less stress? And that question has led me on a quest of reading books by positive reinforcement trainers and then reading all the books listed in the bibliographies of those books or any other trainers mentioned in those books, and just this quest for knowledge. And then I was very fortunate to just happen upon incredible mentors along the way. One of those was Dr. Rosales Ruiz from the University of North Texas, who was incredibly generous with his time during the period of time when I was trying to find a way to help my little pit bull puppy with fear and aggression. And it just sort of went on like that. I just kept learning and striving. And then eventually the day came where my quest, kind of via the Click to Calm book with Emma Parsons, wrote that. And that book was really a meaningful book to me at that time. And I knew she was speaking at Clicker Expo. And I went to Clicker Expo just because Emma was there. And I didn't know anything really about clicker training at the time. I knew about positive reinforcement training, but I didn't know a lot about clicker training. And the day I went to Clicker Expo and saw a dog being shaped, just being shaped to go through a hoop, was the simplest thing. I had never seen anything like it. I mean, the dog was absolutely engaged, completely on fire, you know, that bright offered behavior, that just that complete engagement. I had never seen it. In all the classes where we were feeding treats and kind of luring dogs around, and there was still a lot of sort of I will make you do it kind of feeling to all of that. And this was the first time I'd ever seen a dog offer to do something with such what looked like obvious joy. And I came home from Clicker Expo no longer as focused, obsessively focused on fixing my dog's aggression problems. I came home with the burning desire to learn how to train this way. And that led me to Karen Pryor Academy, where I got a very good education in how to build behaviors to a high level of fluency using clicker training and operant training principles. And again, I think I consider myself first and foremost a brave learner. So I am never satisfied. I just keep striving, keep seeking mentors, I ask a lot of questions. And now I've kind of shifted into more of a teaching mentor role myself. But that, of course, is a huge learning curve and involves a lot more. So that's kind of the arc of the story.
So could we say that you started off herding cats?
Yes, I did.
And using butter. I'm sure those cats were very fond of being herded with butter. Moving on to horses, and so that got you some experience, you said, with a bunch of larger animals. How important was that, do you think, to kind of forming some kind of experience that you could think back to when you got your pit bull?
Well, there's a certain comfort level that I have with the physicality involved in working animals that I don't know if that came from the horses. But I mean, I'm very comfortable with large dogs, with the way dogs can jump on you, that kind of not what I love about clicker training is that it is so hands off and it isn't physical. But I think a big part of being a good trainer is just being comfortably physically in your body. So I got a lot of that, I think, with the horses. Of course, I terribly regret a lot of the training methods that I was using back then. As a teenager, I was just following the instructions of the trainers and mentors I was working with. And really would love someday to go back and have a different relationship with a horse based on positive reinforcement, because I imagine it will be pretty amazing.
And so we started a question in the last recording. It won't be the last episode by the time this comes out, but one of my last recordings with Michael Shikashio, where we asked him if you could go back now as Sarah Owings 2018 and you were to say one thing to Sarah Owings post herding cat training, horse training person, what might you tell Sarah?
Oh my goodness. Well, that would be my 4-year-old self.
back to your horse days.
Yeah. I might tell myself that the 4-year-old had the better idea there of sitting down with attentive, voluntary behavior and reinforcing it. It would, you know, when you go through your teenage years, it's complicated emotionally, and there's a lot of appeal, I think, as a teenager to control things and to control these big animals, right, with the chain over the nose and, you know, the spurs and all that pressure and having that animal comply. Not that I was out there abusing, you know, doing anything abusive. That this was just standard. But it would be really cool if I could go back and say, hey, you remember that 4-year-old self? Do you remember how that felt when all those cats came to you because they wanted to be with you? Maybe you could do that with your horse as well. And that would have really changed the path quite a bit, I think. But it really has taken seeing so many brilliant trainers like Alexander Kurland and seeing that it can be done. That's the inspiration for me over the years.
I just want to stay here just for a second longer because you said something there that I feel relates to how some of the trainers that I come into contact with via Animal Training Academy, and that is a reflection of earlier times in your training journey, and you used the word regret there. You kind of regret some of the things you did. What has that taught you? What has that regret taught you? And what can you offer the listeners of this podcast that might be additionally feeling regret about similar experiences?
Yeah, that's an important question. I don't know a single trainer, especially positive reinforcement trainers, that don't have a laundry list of regrets in their closet, right? And one is, I think it's really helpful to know that you're not alone. I think it was Pat Miller, or I, you know, all the books that I've read were always very inspiring. And there was a story that she put in her book of the day, she was still doing traditional training, and she brought out the leash and choke chain, and her dog went and hid under the house. And that was the day for her, that moment for her where she said, there has to be a better way. But the hope there is the fact that that question, that moment of pain and regret, if you listen to it and follow the next question, which is there has to be a better way, then you are on the path of brave learning, right? The only serious regret, and I don't have it actually because it never happened, is to stay there, to have that feeling, know it's wrong, know your animal's unhappy, and just keep doing it because that's the way it's always been done. And, or it's because what the trainer you hired told you to do, and to stay there and not listen to that voice. I think that would be a worse regret. So that's how I would answer that. But just anytime you have that feeling, I would listen, because even when you're giving positive reinforcement, even when you're giving treats, there are times when you look at your animal and going, you are not having the best time right now because I'm not being clear. And the next question I ask is, can I do this better? Can I be a better teacher? And that never ends.
So kind of you were mentioning there about, I don't know, I'm gonna throw a term out here. I don't know if anyone uses it, like a pivotal moment, like a defining moment that, like with Pat Miller bringing out those pieces of equipment that kind of made her change her mind. And it reminded me of, I went to a non-violent protest kind of workshop with Greenpeace a few years ago, and they define violence, might be going off a tangent here, as knowing there's a better way and doing nothing. And so they said, if you're sitting on the couch, you know, I mean, I feel like it's a little bit manipulative, to be honest, but like you're being violent. So you're saying kind of that would be your biggest regret if you were doing that. And then that led on to you saying, trust your gut. Is that a way of putting it?
Trust that feeling. Then ask the question, there has to be a better way. Then be willing to be brave enough to seek new knowledge, to seek out mentors, to see other ways of doing it. You have to get your ego put aside sometimes to do that, right? To realize that you're not doing it the best way, perhaps. But this is the beauty of positive reinforcement training. And by that, I don't really like that term, but this whole idea that comes from Skinner of successive approximations, that's something we always think about, is you start at a certain place and you are always shaping and modifying behavior towards a goal. And if you take that as a deeper level, a deeper metaphor, it never really ends. And I find that very comforting, because whenever I get into that feeling of, oh, this is not perfect, I'm not good enough, I made too many mistakes in that training session, I can think to myself, okay, rather than say I'm a failure as a trainer, I should just beat myself up and go cry, what I always tell myself is, no, let's be a good clicker trainer for myself here. What are the things I did well? Let's reinforce those. And I make a list. And then I say, okay, I'm going to be a good clicker trainer. What's the one criterion for next session for myself? I'm just going to focus on one thing at a time that I think might help make that better the next time. And I do that for every training session that matters to me. I mean, I do a lot of casual, goofy training where I don't take it quite that seriously. But when it really is important and I feel that is important to do that. I do that with trials too. When I go to competitions, I really focus carefully on I reinforce all the things I feel like I did well. And then I pick one goal for the next competition that I want to focus on. So I don't have 25 things in my head saying you should fix 25 things at once. And that's being a good trainer. That's being a good shaper. And that has kind of fueled the way I like to learn. It's the way I like to help my students work as well. So,
yeah, I like that. And I set a goal at the end of, sorry, the start of July, that I was going to read 5 chapters a week of Ava Bertelsen's Agility Right from the Start. And I put that out there in the world on the Animal Training Academy Facebook page. And someone just said, hey, Ryan, how'd you go with your reading? And I said, very well, thank you. I learned that I'm not going to set goals anymore about reading unless I'm going on holiday.
You need a finer splice your goals.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, maybe just pick up the book once a day.
that's beautiful. But I think the reason I'm sharing that is because it kind of made me, that's what your story made me think about, is that we're always kind of moving from the place that we currently are towards our end goal. And for me, I saw that as a success.
Yes.
I was like, I learned something there.
Yes.
I'm not going to do that next month.
Yeah, that's what brave learning is to me, always. So when a training session goes sideways, which, you know, never happens to me, one good thing I've always learned is I don't hold out for a good one. Do you know when you're doing repetitions and you're like, this is not going well, my animal is frustrated. Oh, but I'm just going to keep going because I have to end on a good note. I let that go a long time ago because you just dig yourself a deeper hole. So I've always given myself permission to end sessions early and go do something fun instead. And then I go have a think about what happened. And then I do this process of, let's look at the things that went well and let's pick the one thing that I think might help make that session more clear next time. I do that all the time. So, and I have my little brown pit bull is talking in the corner here. So if you hear her, that's the one who started it all. So she gets to have a voice sometimes.
Well, she's a very welcome guest on this show. So say thank you to her. We're going to move on, but before we do, because something that we wanted to talk about was the importance of asking good questions. And I remember being right back at the start of my career and having no clue what to do and being told to do things that my gut feeling were going, nah, this is not how I want to proceed. And I remember thinking that someone somewhere could work with this animal using ways that the animals enjoyed and get the results that I was after. I didn't know how to do it. I just needed to figure it out. And something that's really stuck with me throughout my career is a modification of a quote from motivational speaker Tony Robbins, who said, quality questions equal quality life. And I like to say, quality questions equal quality training.
Yes. Yes.
Can you speak to the just unpack this a little bit more? You said you would like to be a brave trainer, and you ask questions like, there has to be a better way.
Yes. Well, one of the tangents that I took in my life before becoming a professional animal teacher was I worked with young children. I got involved in early childhood education, and I was very, very fortunate to work for about 10 years in a deeply progressive kindergarten with another incredible mentor. I should just list all my mentors as, you know, the people that deserve all the credit for anything I say. But this mentor was named Christine Lonergan. And we had a phrase in that classroom, which is, you know, we can't know everything, so we have to be really good at learning. And then we said, we're all brave learners. And the goal of that for kindergartners, five-year-olds, was to really create a safe space for learning, which means we actually celebrated mistakes. We loved the mess of it. We wanted kids to feel like they could express their ideas and no one was going to say, that was wrong, or you didn't spell that right, or your letter's crooked, or... Right. I mean, it was really amazing. And I have to say, living that mantra, we are all brave learners, has gone so far beyond the kindergarten classroom for me. And that it's just part of that ethic of, let's look at those bumpy moments in our lives and in training, look at those rough patches, and let's take that as information. And then let's be brave, because you have to be brave to try something else. You have to be brave to, that's why I love shaping with the dogs, because they have to be brave to offer behavior, right? And if you're afraid of making a mistake, or if you're afraid you're going to be punished, or you're afraid or whatever, you're going to inhibit that, right? So, that little voice in your head that says you must be perfect at all things at all times, that is the great inhibitor in my book. So anytime I get that feeling of, you know, you are not worthy, you don't know how to train, all that stuff, I try and put that aside and go, no, you're really good at learning. You're a brave learner. And one thing I'm very proud of is I don't tend to make the same mistakes over and over and over again. If I have a bad session, the next session will be better. It may not be perfect, but it will be better. I don't do 20 sessions of the same error happening. And I'm very proud of that, because that's more important to me, is to see that there is progress rather than there's perfection. So, but I didn't know we would get on this tangent. This is fun. This is a meaningful one.
Well, Sarah, you're making this very hard for me by being so awesome. And... You touched on lots of things there. Mm-hmm. I think you kind of a big conversation that's happening in my members' Facebook group at the moment is about imposter syndrome. And I think you touched on some of that there. You know, so hopefully that was helpful to the Animal Training Academy members that were having this conversation. And I take that snapshot of the members, which make up the entire population of animal trainers on the planet, as an indication of what a lot of you feel. So I think that's going to be really helpful to others. I wanted to move on, but I'm not going to. Because there's two things there that I think really stood out. First one is, we're all brave learners. Okay, cool. We've just decided the name of the podcast. Wonderful. Secondly, you said you're not alone. And that was in referring to regretting some of the stuff you are doing, or you have done in your career. So I just wanted to reiterate that, bring that back to everyone's attention. And the last thing, just before we move on, that I wanted you to potentially add some more offerings on. You said after you've done a session, or maybe you haven't reached the goal you wanted to reach, you make a list of everything you did achieve. Now, when you say that, are you talking about actually making a physical list?
If the training session, if I'm building like a competition level behavior, then everything has been written down and planned very carefully. If I'm doing more casual training, I might just do this in my head, right? But yeah, a formal physical list. And I think the most helpful thing I can give everyone to get out of that imposter syndrome, and I do not want anyone to think that I have mastered this, because I succumb to it a lot as well. But this, the most helpful thing I've ever come up with, is to be specific with your reinforcement for yourself. So you can't just say you did a good job, because you won't believe it. You'll be like, no, I didn't do a good job. Everything was terrible. You're going to start talking yourself out of that because it's too general. But if you say, hey, your choice to start your dog on a station at the beginning of the session made that beginning of the session start really cleanly. You can't argue with that, because it's just an objective thing that happened, right? And so you could say the first 10 seconds of your session were absolutely clean and perfect. Well, perfect, I hate that word perfect, but you know what I mean? But if you're specific, then, and that's what a good positive reinforcement trainer does, right, is we operationalize the specific behaviors that we want to repeat. But if you just say, you know, be nicer to yourself, or if you keep it big like that, right, that's like those New Year's resolutions or whatever, you're going to fail, because it's not specific enough. Like, you want to read a book every day, then start with lifting a book and looking at the cover and putting it down. Okay, I read the book every day. Success, check. And if you can remember, and it's really, really easier said than done, but if you can remember to do those little things, it will change your habits. And it will change how you view the sessions that go badly. And you will be more motivated to be brave the next day and train again, rather than say, I should just hang my clicker up and never try because I'm terrible.
And we could keep going here, but I'm gonna you know, this is such a relevant conversation, I think, and so beneficial to everyone, regardless of if you're an animal trainer or not in any area of life. So thank you so much for sharing that. Let's push on, though, in the interest of time. And before we do, bring us up to speed as to what you are doing now and where people can go to get in touch with you.
Okay. Well, let's see, up to speed. Okay, I am currently, right now, I'm in transit between two cities, between Los Angeles and San Rafael, California, which is near San Francisco, California. So my business and everything is a little up in the air, but currently I am faculty at Clicker Expo, which is probably the highlight of my entire year, maybe my life, but twice a year I get to basically totally geek out. I mean, I don't even know how my brain is still in my head after doing about 6 years of these things. Totally geek out with some of the geekiest people and most inspiring mentors for 3 full days, twice a year. And I'm beyond honored that I get to do that. So, and this year coming up at Clicker Expo, I'm speaking on this topic that I hope we eventually get around to, which is reframing impulse control in terms of stimulus control, which is a topic I've been really interested in. And then I do a lot of work at Clicker Expo with the fundamentals. Actually, I teach a lab on really understanding cues better. I teach also doing a lecture on non-contingent reinforcement to help with frustration. That's my big thing right now. I'm really thinking that question of there has to be a better way has led me to really question, do we need extinction in our training at all? Do we need, you know, anything, any of that, that causes that kind of frustration? Is that really necessary part of training? So I have a whole talk on non-contingent reinforcement as a teaching strategy. And so that's kind of what I'm really engrossed in. Of course, as you mentioned, my big passion in life is nose work, which we don't want to go there because that needs a whole other. But what I am bringing to Clicker Expo is the perspective that you can do nose work with clicker training principles in mind. There is a little bit of a misperception out there that you can't, that the two are incompatible, that nose work is a natural behavior and therefore you can't shape it, right, with reinforcement. And so I'm just bringing my perspective in there, saying that, you know, the laws of learning apply to all learning in all situations. So it does apply to nose work as well. So I'm just bringing that. But I just have a, that's really where I'm most passionate right now, is learning how to use, teach clicker trainers how to do nose work. And gosh, I don't have a website right now. I'm hard to reach. I would say people should reach me via Facebook. If you look up Sarah Owings on Facebook and friend me, and if anyone messages me and says, I heard you on Ryan's podcast, I want to follow you, that would definitely get you into my exclusive group of friends. So that's probably the easiest way to keep track of what I'm doing. But next year, once I move and I'm settled, I have a lot of big plans of stuff that I want to have my own podcast and really start really sharing a lot of the learning that I'm doing every day with my dogs at home. So.
Awesome. Excited about your podcast and just letting you know we're going to be experimenting over the next wee while. We're starting a podcast network potentially via Animal Training Academy. So you want somewhere, if you want somewhere for your podcast to live.
Oh, that would be awesome. Saying.
Hey, thank you so much for sharing all of that, Sarah. I really appreciate it. We're going to unpack even more of what you just started to touch on just then.
Good.
With some of that impulse control and stimulus control stuff. So let's get going on this. When you were just giving that little bit of information about where people can go to find you now, and we'll link to that stuff in Karen Pryor Academy and your Facebook and stuff, if it's okay with you, in the podcast write-up so people can find you. But you said something there. You said you're interested in reframing impulse control to stimulus control.
Yes.
Can you tell us what you mean by this?
Okay. Well, this is a big topic to unpack. So we'll just see what we can do in the time we have. This is something that I've been really interested in thinking about, definitely fueled by that question, you know, is there a better way? So, and I don't know if it's as prevalent in the zoological community. I was going to ask you this idea of impulse control, this idea that one of the goals of training is to teach impulse control. And it is kind of a vague term. But if you look up what it means in terms of, you know, human language, you know, human definitions, it's very much applied in terms of self-help, like dieting, you know, quitting smoking. It's whenever you look it up, it's in psychology, it's related to that kind of thing. And it has definitely the core definition of impulse control in human terms is the ability to delay gratification, right? So the idea is that, and I actually read this somewhere, which I found it really fascinating, was it was this idea, very gleefully stated, by the way, that Skinner was wrong because the fact that we have impulse control means that we are not in control of the stimuli that are in front of us are not in control of us. So what that means is if you have a cupcake in front of you and you choose not to eat it, it proves that that stimulus usually means eat, right? You see it, it's in front of you, and you would just eat it. But if you say no thank you, ha-ha, you know, Skinner was wrong. I found that really funny because that's just completely not what this is. Anyway, but that's where we're coming from here, is this idea that if you resist the stimulus in front of you, if you don't do the behavior that's normally associated with that stimulus, right? So you don't eat the cupcake, you don't smoke the cigarette, right? You are practicing something called impulse control. And there's a ton of, and I would call this what Dr. Friedman calls cultural fog around this. There's a lot of, whenever we hear that word impulse control, there's sort of this assumption that you're going to be a better person, you're going to have a better life, right? They even did those sort of weird tests with little kids, the marshmallow test years ago, where they would put a marshmallow, and if the kids resisted the marshmallow, they were supposedly going to have much more successful careers. That has been debunked quite a bit, actually, to show that there are a lot of other factors that relate to success in life besides resisting marshmallows. But anyway, so my point here, the reason I'm jumping off from this kind of abstract human definition, is that I think when we come to the world of dog training, this is a very important concept to many, many dog trainers. And in fact, I think the first puppy class I ever took, and I think it's true for almost every puppy, pet owner, not just puppies, pet owner, class 101, they teach an exercise called Leave It. And the whole idea is this exercise will teach impulse control. And what it is basically, and if you go on YouTube and you just type in dog training plus impulse control, you're going to see about 100 examples of this, is you hold food in your hand, right? That's like the cupcake. The dog tries to eat it because that makes sense, right? You've got food right in front of them. And the dog will, you'll close your fingers and then the dog will bite it. They might paw at it. They might bark at it. They might stare at it. I've met some really long duration master stare dogs. I always joke that they're like trying to hypnotize the food out of the hand. But they basically are going through what is called an extinction burst, right? And that's it. You're using extinction on purpose as a training tool there to say, hey, dog, this food in hand thing, it's not going to work for you. None of those behaviors are going to work. The moment the dog gives up and backs off, he gets clicked and rewarded, right? Until pretty soon the dog learns food in the hand means back off and don't do anything, just wait. And this is so prevalent. I mean, you'll see with dog trainers, I've seen people do it with a dog's water bowl when the dog is really thirsty, and they'll start to lower the water bowl. And if the dog gets up early, they'll take the water away, which is a teaching strategy known as negative punishment, which means you're trying to punish the dog for getting up early. This idea is that globally, eventually these dogs will learn to control their impulses. And the idea is that it will generalize to not chasing a squirrel, not jumping on Grandma Tilly when she comes over, right? And so when you really unpack it, and I'm absolutely not saying we shouldn't teach our dogs life skills so they can be calm and focused and content around reinforcement, right? I'm not saying we shouldn't teach them those skills, but I want to unpack this simply because I adopted a dog named Tucker 3 years ago, and he taught me the very important lesson that extinction is not your friend. It's not a very helpful teaching tool. He's the kind of dog that if you said, here's a reinforcer, you can't have it, just wait till you give up. He's not giving up. He will scream bark for half an hour, right? Before he even takes a breath, before you have anything, you have nothing to reinforce. There's no moment of, oh, I give up. And so I got to that moment of, I adopted this dog. He was labeled as having impulsivity problems. Some of the things related to barking around toys, snatching things from your hand. He would snatch anything that you had in your hands. He even snatched scissors that I was carrying once. Luckily, it was handles end first. And he would take toys so roughly that it was unsafe. He would snatch clothing. He would grab leashes and pull people over. He had just this intensity about him, and I was told he needed lots of impulse control training. And when I went to do the standard way, the way it's normally done, it was a failure. I mean, it was exactly what I told you about earlier, was I would have session after session. And remember, I don't do more than 3 sessions repeating the same error of, wow, we're not making any progress. He's just screaming at me. There has to be a better way. So I dug a little deeper and I started just really thinking about what is going on here. What do I really want him to do? Why is he failing at the task that I want him to do? And then it I just realized the day I realized that when you hold up a tennis ball, that is a cue to bark nonstop. I stopped thinking of it as an impulse control problem. And I started to realize, oh, this is a very well-established, very fluent behavior. Someone else taught it. It's on cue. It's beautifully on cue. You hold up a tennis ball, he starts to bark. He barks nonstop until it's thrown, right? As soon as I started to unpack it in terms of stimulus control, and I will talk about what that means, everything kind of opened up in my mind, because the process of teaching, when you teach a behavior to an animal using clicker training principles, is you shape the behavior you want first. You do it more or less off cue, right? Then you add the cue when the behavior is strong enough and fluent, right? So, but here I wasn't getting any behavior to reinforce. It was already on a cue. And I was essentially saying, hey, dog, same antecedent conditions. I want you to do something else. I want you to be quiet and whatever that is, mouth closed. And it was impossible for him to offer me anything else, because he actually had really good stimulus control on a ball, right? So do you see how it changed my mindset? And once I started thinking of it like a clicker trainer, and I started thinking about antecedents, so one of the big antecedents arrangements I was really helpful with him was, okay, let's work on this in a context where you don't have an association with toys. Let's work on stuff without toys even present. Let's figure out what behavior I want instead of this barking. Let's make that stronger, like gangbusters. And basically the behavior I really wanted, I started with him, was what I call stand and wait. And it is basically, for him, it was very important. He was a movement and arousal and pacing and barking and panting were all part of the package. So the first behavior I started capturing in a non-toy related context was standing still. And I used food reinforcement. Luckily, food reinforcement was not as difficult for him to be calm around. And I just used food reinforcement to capture standing still like crazy, until he actually had a big reinforcement history for it. And it was on the cue of me standing in front of him with a lower level reinforcer, or a different reinforcer. I wouldn't call it lower level. It was just his response to food was very different than his response to toys. So then the next step I did with him was I taught him release cues. Release cues are like a little dress rehearsal for what cues are. So what is a cue? Let me get back up a little bit, just to discuss what stimulus control really is. Stimulus control basically means that an animal, or it could be human animals, all organisms fall into this group, will perform a behavior in the presence of a cue or a certain stimulus, and not perform that behavior in its absence. So it's basically when, you know, we are processing stimuli around us all the time. There's way more stimuli coming at us than our brain can even process. But when a specific thing kind of stands out and becomes a discriminative stimuli, becomes a cue that affects our behavior in some way, then we say that cue, that stimulus, is having stimulus control over our behavior. So the ball was the stimulus that was controlling the barking behavior. And I wanted that ball to cue a stand and wait behavior instead. That was my goal. So just to reframe, the old way of doing this, the way that most people would do it, is to stand in front of the dog with the ball and wait for the barking to extinguish. That's the extinction. So you would just wait for the behavior you want, and the dog would bark and bark and bark and bark and bark. And I actually have videos of this, which we can post, of just pretty much nonstop barking until the dog takes a breath, or they run out of, you know, they get tired for half a second, and then you throw the ball. And that is what I call a very messy emotional loop, which means You get this huge spike of frustration and arousal. Remember that all of that is still attached to those antecedents, right? So it's still attaching, all the stuff you don't want is still happening. It's still attached to you standing there with a ball. Then they just happened to get it right and they get reinforced. If you're lucky, the dogs will figure it out. But now you have that loop that really, it's really, really messy emotionally. And I wanted it clean. I wanted it to be, he knows how to stand in front of me quietly. He can do it with food reinforcement. So I taught him, stand in front of me quietly. I will release you to food. And he got that. He really got that really, really well. So he learned his release cues beautifully. He learned how to stand and wait. He learned that that behavior works very well. And then I gradually brought in kind of through a hierarchy of different objects that kind of look like toys. So I could just fade in toward the context that was most difficult. And then I put all his toy related stuff on cue. So what he does now, which you'll see in the video that we might post later, is he waits. He's just as excited. He's just as, there's whatever impulses are happening, he's still having impulses. You can see his pupils are dilated. He's quivering. He's super excited. It's not like the impulses left his body and went away, right? But now the ball cues this stand and wait behavior, and he waits for the word go. When he hears the magic word go, he runs like hell, and it means I'm going to chuck it. That is, now that he is waiting for the most important cue in that package now is the word go for him. And that's what stimulus control means, is that you've taught the animal what is the most salient green light in that package, right? So it's not me standing there. It's not me holding the ball up, right? Those are not, that's not what he's waiting for anymore. Now he's just waiting for the word go. And just through careful training, I was able to narrow that down for him. I am not saying he's never barks at me, but that immediate, overwhelming, nonstop, total barking on the cue of a ball being present is, I would say it almost never happens anymore. It's just, the only time it comes up is if I'm being ridiculously slow or stupid or talking, I get distracted and talk on my phone or something, which I would never do when there's a ball present. But anyway, so you probably have questions about some of that. That was a lot of information.
Yep, I do. So let me just try to find my notes here. He had, you mentioned to me before we started recording that you were just listening to the Peter Clark episode.
Yes.
That's the Peter Clark episode of this podcast show. And one thing that I really liked in that episode is Peter nearly started singing. She said, it's always ABC.
Yes.
It's always ABC.
Yep.
It's always ABC.
Yep.
Was it for you learning more or you know, asking your questions, how can I do it better? Was it kind of reaching for that tool, that way of breaking down what you've called in here, and maybe we need to unpack this a little bit more, the packages, mm-hmm. package of information available to the animal. Was it really like starting to use those ABCs that made you have that mind shift?
Absolutely. The biggest shift was just looking at the antecedent conditions first. I used to be very, I mean, of course, the contingencies are crucial as well. But as Dr. Friedman likes to tell us all the time, we only can control the environment. So we can control the A and we can control the C, but we really can't control the animal. Right. And that's why I chafe a little bit about this idea of impulse control, because I mean, I'm sure there are, not everyone thinks this way, but when I hear the word impulse control, I can't not think of something inside the animal, right? An impulse in their brain goes, fires wrong, or it's a bad choice they're making, or they're just too high drive, or they're genetically, there's so many internal things that start coming up when I think impulse control, right? When I think stimulus control, I start looking at mostly the A's, right? The antecedent conditions mostly. And that relates to how clear and how successfully I'm teaching, how clearly and how successfully I'm teaching. So the onus of behavior is on me as the teacher, as the trainer. It's not on the dog, you know, because I watch a lot of people working with their dogs, and I've seen very good, very, thoughtful, ethical trainers for whom impulse control, the concept of it is like the core of their training. And I've seen them do a beautiful shaping where there's minimal frustration and they get beautiful results. So I'm not criticizing people for that. But what I see a lot is that when we think our dogs should be exhibiting good impulse control, and then the day that they don't, right, when they act like a dog and they roll in the cat poop or they eat your garbage or they steal your sandwich, which is all completely normal behaviors for a dog to do, it's, if you're thinking about impulse control, it's very easy. The next step in your mind is, my dog did it wrong. My dog has a flaw. My dog screwed up. You know, bad dog. I mean, it's just, I'm not saying people all think that way who think impulse control, but it's just easy. And I know a lot of pet owners that get in that mindset of like, you know better, you know, they start talking to their dogs like this, you know better. But when you think stimulus control, and I'm always a little sad because the word stimulus control is not sexy enough to have really captured people's imaginations. That's kind of why I'm on a mission to help people feel inspired to think about stimulus control. But when you think stimulus control, you're thinking about the communication between you and the animal. And you're also thinking about the information between the environment and the animal. And now you have stuff to work with, right? Because you can control the environment. Like I did with my dog, was instead of going out to the play yard every day and struggling with him, which was the wrong antecedent environment to teach him what I wanted, I moved him into a quiet room in the shelter, where he had no associations with toys, and he was able to give me the behavior I wanted in that context. But if I didn't have the ABCs in my head, I might have gotten stuck in that mindset of like, let's just take you out there and you're going to learn this behavior doesn't work and we're going to just do it the hard way, right? And so absolutely, it was because I have amazing mentors like Susan Friedman, who's also a mentor of Petta Clark's, right? Of it's always the ABCs. And once you go there, you've got the tools to help that animal learn what you need them to learn.
And so earlier you said that you think there's, and once again, referring back to the teachings of Susan Friedman and what she's brought into our community is this idea around cultural fog. And if you resist the stimulus in front of you, you're practicing something called impulse control. Mm-hmm. So you said that this is something that you might place in that cultural fog bucket. Mm-hmm. And for the people listening to this podcast who might be going, yeah, no, I completely feel you, Sarah Owings. Oh, wow. Like, I never really thought about it like this. Oh, my God. How do I get out of this bucket? what advice do you have for us moving forward? Because, you know, that what you're saying, and I've been heavily influenced myself by Susan Friedman, and would place her in my mentor bucket too, is that I'm always going back to those ABCs, mm-hmm. and I'm there navigating my way around through this fog. So what advice do you have for people as we move forward, and building our understanding, whether you want to or not, maybe you don't want to, that's your choice, of ABCs and kind of mm-hmm. getting out of this fog. How do we navigate out of the fog?
Well, the first thing is to recognize it's there. And that's why I kind of make a big point of just pointing out what does, when human beings think of the word impulse control, we think of all these things like, you know, being a better person, being moral, you know, delayed gratification means you've got good character, you know, all of those things. And I'm not saying those things are not important, but that's all in our heads, right? And that gets in the way of seeing what is actually affecting our animals' behavior. Because in the animals' world, what they're doing makes perfect sense to them. It works for them. It has nothing to do with any of this, you know, Tucker barked nonstop because people would eventually throw balls for him. There's no morality there. There's no, for him, it's just the way life is. And it was really helpful for me to just step back and go, wait a minute, this is no different than any other behavior that I have trained, right? I might call it a problem behavior, right? Because I don't like, you know, scream barking is not that fun to live with. But it really wasn't a problem behavior. It was actually, once I look at the videos, and when you see the video, you're going to be like, well, that's beautifully on cue. It's fluent. It's got low latency. It's got high intensity, long duration, persistence, like all the things that actually make Tucker a very good nose work dog. All those things were apparent in his ability to sustain this behavior on the cue of a ball. So if you just kind of step back, and I guess to make it practical for people, right? Because when we say big words like antecedents, I think people can get into the geeky words. I don't like to dumb anything down, but you can make things practical and easier. So what I do with my clients who are working with often problems is what we often start with is the question, okay, so your dog really, really struggles in this context, right? We've clearly defined exactly what that context is. So now let's very, very clearly define context where your dog can be successful. Have we put as much effort into defining those contexts? Most people, and I know I did that with my little brown pit bull puppy way back in the day, I spent all my time focused on the context where she really struggled, right? And I almost didn't put any effort, because I was too exhausted by the end of the day, really, to put any effort into the context where she was fantastic and relaxed and happy. So if we think in terms of where can the dog do it, right? And we start there. If we just put that as a starting point, and then we think, and you want to think about everything, like, okay, if the dog has a lot of trouble with you with a food pouch on, and that is cueing a overexcited, stressful, jumping up on you, mugging you, all those behaviors you don't want, right, which are often labeled impulsive, then maybe let's try something else. Let's put the food in a bowl on a shelf somewhere in the other room. So that's not part of the antecedents. Okay, now can your dog stand calmly and look at you? Great. Mark it, walk all the way to the bowl and reinforce it, or find a way to manipulate that in the antecedent conditions so that your dog can offer you the behaviors you want. And then you just start building. You build from there. And you just fade into the problem context if necessary. Often I say to a lot of people, hey, if we can avoid those problem contexts, if it's possible, it's not always possible, but if we can just avoid those problems and just spend all your time building strong behaviors in good contexts, and that can be your animal's life, let's do that. Let's not even go down that road. Like, why does your dog need to go walk down a busy highway with dogs barking at them? Like, is that necessary part of your dog's life? Can we change the antecedents and maybe take your dog to a big park where it's open and relaxing? Is that possible? So I'm always working with clients now, and that first question, the most practical question, and it is about the ABCs, is what are the antecedent conditions where behaviors you want are being cued, right, are being inspired in the animal? And that's where you start.
And I forgot to say earlier, I think we might have to replace that earlier title that we came up with for this episode and change it to stimulus control is not sexy enough. Quite like that one.
Yeah. Oh, can I talk about that a little bit?
Do it.
Okay. So I don't know about all your listeners, but when I first came to the world of clicker training, remember I mentioned that story at Clicker Expo where I was so excited to see a dog offering behavior, right? And it was the simplest thing. It was Joan Orr. She was sitting in a chair. Joan Orr, if you don't know her, she's on crutches. She has so mobility issues. So she was completely hands off. All she had was a clicker and treat tosses. And this beautiful dog was on fire and offering behavior and learned very quickly to just jump through a hoop. It was awesome. Okay, I saw that. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And I went and bought 10 books on clicker training. And right, I jumped in. I know a lot of people like this. And the first exercise that everyone says to do in those early clicker books, this is changing now as people get more refined, is 101 things to do with a box. So 101 things to do with the box felt like the 60s. It felt like free love. It felt like there were no rules. Nothing could go wrong. The dog is always right, right? And you basically put the box down and anything the dog does with it, you're going to click that dog and reinforce it. And then you're going to wait till the dog does something else. And it's so cool. And it looks great. Often what I have discovered, okay, and that's the sexy part, right? And all the books are often, there's a lot of talk about how to do the shaping part, right? And how to get into all that and how to do it all. And then you get to the part on stimulus control, because there are three steps to training. Step one is you build your behavior with shaping or capturing. Step two is you add a cue, basically by presenting that cue just before the behavior happens anyway, right? And it starts to attach. But step three, to get stimulus control, remember that the rule is the animal will only offer the behavior in the presence of the cue and not offer the behavior in the absence. This is the sticker. Number three is the tricky one, because you've just reinforced your dog many, many times for offering behavior, right? And what people forget, again, they're forgetting the antecedents, that is on cue. It's on the cue of the handler standing there with the treats. The dog knows the picture. They go, okay, you're standing there. You got reinforcers. I start doing things. I get reinforced for it. That's on cue already. Now you want to change the rules. And step three is the hardest one, the stickler. And the rules now change to, okay, dog, I'm no longer going to reinforce you when you offer me behavior. No more. Now I'm only going to reinforce you when I've said this word sit or whatever. And in the old way we used to do it, it again involved extinction, which was extinction is when you're expecting reinforcement. The antecedent conditions are telling you reinforcement is available. You do the behavior that should get you reinforcement and it doesn't happen. And then you go through either doing the behavior harder, you do more of it, you try other things, you go through a repertoire of things, and then extinction, full extinction is when you just give up and go, well, that's just, it's hopeless, I can't do anything. So you basically kind of put your dog through that at step three. And when the moment the dog gives up and goes, okay, the cue machine is broken, I will just sit here and look at you, then you give the cue that you've been wanting your dog to listen to. They're supposed to do the behavior and they get reinforced. Now, savvy dogs, resilient dogs can learn this pattern pretty quickly. They can catch on. They fast map this process quickly and the stress level is fairly low. Other dogs, like my dog Tucker, for example, never let you get away with that. There's just no way. So again, I was stuck with that moment of, I want him waiting for this cue. I can't use extinction. It's off the table. What can I do instead? So that I have a whole strategy for that. But the basic thing just boils down to, again, am I being clear enough with my teaching? Am I breaking the skills down? Does my animal have the skill in place, and are my context cues clear? So one of the big tips I have for my students who are studying clicker training is, have you made the context cues clear when you are doing a session where you want offered behavior? And have you made context cues clear that you want your dog to default to a waiting behavior, right? And if your context cues are exactly the same for both, how does your dog know? How can you give that information to the animal? Okay, we're doing a cueing session now. And the way I do it is I always use stationing. So my animals are very familiar with this. Stationing means my animals are on a bed or a crate while I get the session set up. As soon as they're released into the work area, right, I have two modes of going on, right? I have to be very quick within a second. This animal has to know we are doing shaping. So you will be expected to just offer behavior. Or within a second, that animal has to know we're doing cueing, which means in the absence of any cues, the default is waiting, that beautiful stand and wait. So I work really hard to make those two conditions very, very clear to my animals. And the way it works with my dogs is, especially when I get to that step three, right, that moment where we've shaped a behavior, I've done the adding cue part, we need to shift into the waiting part. What I will do is release the dog from station and I start feeding for stand and wait first. It's the first behavior we build that session on. And because of all that reinforcement history, remember I built that behavior previously. As soon as I start doing that, the animal I'm working with knows, okay, this is the rule structure for this session. When in doubt, just stand and wait. And then I'll start giving cues. And then I add little pauses between the cues. And I will either reinforce for standing and waiting, or I will reinforce with giving the cue, which is also a reinforcer. So that's how I ease into that step three without that burst of frustration where the animal is just trying and trying and trying to figure out that the rules have changed. And that's why I don't like that leave it exercise, because again, I consider it a rule change. Most dogs have learned over the years that when a human holds food out, that is a cue to eat. Yes, makes sense? So that is what it means. So that moment where you say rules have changed, hand with food in it no longer means eat. That is that moment where the animal has to go, whoa, the rules have changed. And I try really hard as a teacher to be fair with my communication. In fact, I have that quote, my favorite quote from Karen Pryor, I could insert, which is about what stimulus control is. And if there's if people want to learn why stimulus control is sexy, this is it. So this is a quote from Karen Pryor from her book, Don't Shoot the Dog, which everyone should read at least once a year. And she writes this, and I have this posted up in my training room. And she writes that good stimulus control is nothing more than true communication, honest, fair communication. It's the most complex, difficult, and elegant aspect of training with positive reinforcement. And I find that to be intriguing and inspiring. And I still haven't unpacked everything in that statement, but I'm getting there. So good. I'm sure you have questions.
I do, but I'm also looking at the time. So we're going to leave the questions on the table for people to come to Clicker Expo and to reach out to you and to explore some more of your courses and start conversations on social media in your safe environments, in your safe tribes, and all of those things. And for the next month, because you've just thrown out a challenge there. For the next month, I'm going to pick up my copy of Don't Shoot the Dog and put it back down again once every day.
Excellent. Just read the first word.
Oh, we're lumping.
Okay.
Come on.
Okay, I'm sorry. Just pick it up. Sorry. Just pick it up.
I'm joking. Hey, thank you so much for that. I mean, as I just alluded to, there are a lot of questions on the table, a ton, and I'm sure the listeners of this podcast as well have a ton. So
yeah, I will also, if you can, put in a few articles where I go into great detail on these, on release cues and stimulus control and toy-related cues, which are all interrelated based on what I've learned in the last couple years. And so you can put those links in and people can read about it as well and with video examples. So that will be helpful.
And we'll have to create some more content in the future to answer some of these questions as well. We are sadly heading towards the end.
Yes.
But that's okay, because we're heading into one of my favorite parts of the podcast show. Mm-hmm. It's hard to say with all of the amazing stuff that came before, but this is one of my favorite parts. It's called story time. Can you share with everyone listening, Sarah, maybe one or two more pinnacle stories from your experience training animals and some lessons these have taught you?
Pinnacle stories. Oh my gosh.
I've never used the term pinnacle stories before. It just came out.
Wow. So. It's a little difficult to pick and choose, I will be honest with you. Definitely the work I've done with both my two dogs, were both of those were huge pinnacle moments in my development. And I guess I've talked a lot about Tucker in the last story, but to go back to that little brown pit bull puppy, one of the pinnacle moments for her and for me was this idea of fixing her, right? This sort of egoistic trainer idea that I did have it when I was idealistic, that I could use behavioral principles, right? This beautiful technology that I was so passionate about, and it was just, it looked amazing, and I was learning about it every day. I could use that technology to fix her, to take away all the fear and the aggression, and I could basically fix anything. Like, the dog was a clean slate, and I could just write whatever I wanted on there if I was good enough, right? It had a lot of that perfectionism and ego and all that. And my little puppy is named Zoe, who's now 14 years old. She told me very clearly every day that you are trying to basically push a square peg in a round hole, and you're trying really hard. And no matter how much chicken I fed her, no matter how many classes I took her to, no matter how many experts I, you know, and no matter how many books I read, she would leave the house and she would flatten on the ground and go pancake, like a pancake dog, not want to move. And when she got home, she would brighten, she would blossom, she would, right? And I remember writing to Kay Lawrence, this was a pinnacle moment. I wrote to Kay Lawrence, you know, one of those long, my dog has all these problems. I'm sure everybody gets them, and, you know, we all kind of roll our eyes, but everybody has been there, everyone. So I had great empathy. And Kay Lawrence got all the way to the end of my long letter, and she wrote back to me. This was a pinnacle moment. And she said, I'm going to tell you something and you're not going to want to hear it. Right. Which is, Kay is very good at that. And she said, why does your dog have to leave the house? Why does she even have to do any of that? That is more about what you want than what she wants. And even to the day, I tear up just that moment, that realization, because I thought I was doing everything right. And that, I had to grieve. I quit all the classes that day. I called everyone. I lost tons of money on all the, I cried for a week. I grieved for the dog that I wish I could have had, you know, you have to go through that grieving process, because I had this vision of this beautiful, perfect, happy dog that I could take everywhere and she'd love everyone. And it wasn't until I really let go of it. You can't just say you're letting go of it. You have to really let go of it, that she began to blossom, you know, and I brought enrichment to her home, to my home. Her life is good. I'm all weeping now just thinking of it. She taught me everything that I know. She got me on this path of being a better trainer and asking that question, there has to be a better way, every single day. And she's a very happy dog. She's brilliant, savvy. I call her the champion of my living room. And that was an incredible lesson to have, right? And I think a lot, I can bring a lot of empathy to a lot of the pet owners I work with who have that same mindset, is if I hire you and I use this clicker and these treats, will I fix my dog, you know? And the answer is, of course, behavior is changeable. You should always be optimistic. It wasn't that my dog couldn't have a happy life. She wasn't damaged goods. It was that I needed to put her in the antecedents. I needed to look at the right conditions so she could have the life where she could blossom and be a confident, brilliant dog. So, that's the best story I have right now. I don't think there's anything better, but I'm sure there's more, but that's probably enough.
Hey, I'm all about creating emotive responses in people when they listen to this. Mm-hmm. And I just want to just share gratitude to you for sharing that, because mm-hmm. I can see you now, and mm-hmm. I appreciate the listeners of this podcast can't. And I was thinking to myself, is she welling up? Is she welling up?
Yeah. And that was 11 years ago, 12 years ago. It's still a very powerful memory and changed the course of everything I do. You know, I mean, that's happened many times on my road, but that was a huge one. Just that one, and just because Kay was kind enough to respond with honesty and not give me a list of 50 solutions either. You know, try this training method, try that, read this book, da, 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 you know, do this, do that. She's just like, why? Your dog, she says, Zoe is telling you clearly what she needs. Time to listen.
This is so valuable. Mm-hmm. So very valuable. I already know people I'm going to be sharing that story with. So thank you so much for sharing. And you definitely didn't disappoint with brand new addition to Animal Training Academy podcast, the language of pinnacle moments.
Yes. Or, all right. Are you collecting those?
Yeah, we just always trying to ask the question, Sarah, how I can do things better. Mm. And so if we can create the recollection of memory in guests by saying things like pinnacle moments, then I don't know, see what happens. It worked that time. I'm reinforced for using that word very strongly.
Excellent. You'll do it again.
Can you please take us into the future now before we wrap up and just tell us, being the listeners of this show, what you would like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal training world?
Oh, goodness. There is so much happening now that it's a little bit mind-blowing, actually. 10 years ago, there were just like 2 clicker lists or something on Yahoo of people getting together and discussing things. Now it's like, it's an explosion. So number one is I'm really excited about what's going on, and people are really excited that people are going deeper into the questions. This just like I do, I see lots of people asking that question. Is there a better way? Is my dog really comfortable with this, even though I'm giving treats? You know, people really going deep with this. So that is huge, and I love it. And I hope that just continues and grows, and that these communities continue to nurture each other. I mean, you've done a beautiful job creating a community where, because, you know, there's also all the nasty stuff that we all encounter online with where it's hard to communicate, it's harder to be brave. And I try very, very hard to follow my other personal motto, which is if I'm okay with me, I don't have to make you wrong. I really follow that anytime I get into any discussions where it's about who's wrong or right, I step back and go, well, it's, you know, if I'm okay with me, if I'm feeling defensive, then I need to check myself, because I think more dog trainers who are engaging in discussions of things to maybe take that motto on a little bit is, if I'm okay with me, I don't have to make you wrong. I can share my ideas. I can have insights, and then I can come around 5 years later and say, hey, all those ideas I shared, I have new ideas, better ideas. I've changed my mind because I'm always learning. So I guess I'd like to see more support for the brave young innovators. You know, I had an experience with a friend who, she came up with a beautiful training protocol. She was a young trainer. It was a very useful training protocol. She worked really hard on it. There was nothing wrong with it other than it was an official training protocol. And she put it out there. She shared it. It was really useful to a lot of people. And then she got really attacked by a lot of people because they didn't want a new training protocol. They didn't think, you know, there was just a lot of attacks on her, and she was brand new. She was being brave. It was good thinking. It was a good approximation. There was nothing wrong with what she put out. And I would like us to be more supportive of that, that we just should support innovative, positive reinforcement people and keep being generous with them and helping them grow. Because everybody's on this journey, and all the people that have helped me on my journey have made huge differences. So that was a very long answer to that question. But I hope some of it lands in places that's meaningful to others.
If I'm okay with me, I don't need to make you wrong. a lot of meaning in there, Sarah. Thank you very much for sharing. Just before we do officially wrap up, I know we've already mentioned this towards the start of the episode, but just remind everyone listening where they can go to get in touch with you and say hi.
So like I said, I think the best way to get in touch with me would be via Facebook right now, because I am in transition. So I don't have I don't have a website up right now. I'm going to rebuild everything and I'm going to be inspired and start fresh. So if you contact me on Facebook and you mention this podcast and you are interested in following, I often post lessons of the day that I learn from Tucker and Zoe. I often have thoughts of the day. So usually when I'm on my walks talking to myself like you do, Ryan, I will have a thought, and I don't have time in my life right this moment to really formally do blogs and things like that. So I often will go to Facebook and just type out a thought for the day and engender, oh, that's the right word, get some good conversation going. I love conversation on my page. I love encouraging it. And so definitely join me and keep following what I'm doing, because eventually I'll have more outlets.
Podcast show to come, 2019.
Yeah. And you can come to Clicker Expo. Got some fun talks at Clicker Expo. If you just look up Clicker Expo, you'll find the link to the next two there next year, January and March, in the United States.
Looking forward to them coming to Australasia.
Yes, that'll be awesome. I'm sure they want to go everywhere.
Wonderful. And we'll put links in the show notes, as well as videos that we've talked about today and the articles that Sarah mentioned, and anything else. If we haven't linked something, let us know and we'll put it in there. So, Sarah, this has been so much fun.
Oh, absolutely.
From myself and on behalf of all of the listeners of this show, we really appreciate you taking time to come on the show with us today, but also this is the second time we've caught up for a video chat, and we've been sending messages back and forth. And so all the time and effort you've put into creating this episode, Sarah, thank you very, very much.
Absolutely. My pleasure. It's been delightful. And I'll do it anytime. You don't even have to do it officially. You can just call me and we can talk.
Awesome. I am incredibly blessed. And we, of course, really appreciate all of you out there around the world tuning in today as well.
Yeah, thank you.
If you've enjoyed this episode and you were interested in, like Sarah just said, carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as a Netflix social media platform for behavior nerds. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we are looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.